From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Great Recession left broad swaths of this country battered, but as the recession recedes, we're seeing areas emerge not only resilient but robust. Tech hubs, the energy belt, college towns, more. Writer and city guru Richard Florida has thought hard about what makes cities, regions thrive. Now he's looking at which cities have come out ahead since the recession, which have not, and why. This hour, On Point, Richard Florida on the new economic map of America. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. How has your city, town, region come out of the recession? Has it? What's made your corner of the country resilient? What's made it vulnerable? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we'll talk to Nashville Mayor Carl Dean. Nashville's being called Nowville these days. We'll look at what's happening to the real estate market in different parts of the country later in the hour as well. But first, joining me from New York is Richard Florida, big thinker on what makes different places succeed. He's director of the think tank of the Martin Prosperity Institute at the University of Toronto's Rotman School of Management. He's editor-at-large at the Atlantic City, senior editor at the Atlantic. His books include The Rise of the Creative Class and The Great Reset. He's author of the article in the October issue of the Atlantic, The Boomtowns and Ghost Towns of the New Economy. Richard Florida, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Oh, Tom, thanks for having me. It's great to be back. And by the way, I'm also – the reason I'm in New York is I'm also a joint appointment as a global research professor at NYU. So
bravo.
That's why we're here.
Bravo, NYU. Bravo,
thank
you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So this is really interesting, both to kind of create a – help us create a mental map of what's – where the economy's moving, where it's not, and why. But also it's pointing to some bigger issues and, well, deep issues for this country about – equality, inequality, how it's spreading out, where we're going to live, who's going to prosper and who's not. We'll look at all of that. But just give us the big 30,000, 40,000 foot overview. Who's coming back? Who's prospering and who's not? What are the trends post-recession, Richard?
Well, it's really interesting. You know, my editor at The Atlantic, Don Peck, who's just a brilliant guy and wrote a book on the jobs and the jobs crisis in America a couple mm-hmm. of years back, encouraged me 5 years into this crisis or so to take a look at what's happened. At the dawn of the crisis, I wrote a big feature for The Atlantic on this reshaping of our geography. So I had to really dig in and actually, for folks listening, and pored through a tremendous amount of data from the U.S. government and also from a great economics firm called EMC. They have this incredible micro data, up-to-the-minute real-time data on our jobs picture. What I was able to conclude is that I had partly gotten it right the first time, that clearly big global cities like New York were doing pretty well. High-tech centers like San Francisco Bay Area, the Silicon Valley, Austin, Texas, and the like, and the college towns that you mentioned mm-hmm. that were having these healthcare jobs and technology jobs and professional jobs were doing pretty well.
You're talking Boulder and Ann Arbor and Charlottesville
yes. yeah, Madison,
and Champaign-Urbana,
Wisconsin.
Madison, Lawrence, Kansas.
Yeah. Lawrence, Kansas has actually performed particularly well. Mm-hmm. Even it's become kind of a tech center in its own way. Mm-hmm. But also what I had not really focused on at that point was the – and which other people have made clear, this incredible rebound in the energy piece of the economy. And that's the Houstons, the Oklahoma cities, even the areas around New Orleans. And then ultimately what was very encouraging – was to see some uptick in places like Greater Detroit. And yes, Detroit has had investment in its core and a comeback downtown, but actually it's had one of the higher rates of productivity growth and a big uptick in its good jobs. Now, obviously, that's tied to the bounce back of manufacturing. So I think it's a little bit more complicated picture. Going to the other side that you mentioned, mm-hmm. one of the things I wanted to look at was this growing concern in America, a real concern about inequality. And what I found is that inequality is, of course, growing. And the reason why is big part of our recovery has been low-wage, low-pay jobs.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the constant across regions, you know. Even the regions that have done well, San Jose, the Silicon Valley, New York, Washington, D.C., have generated a lot. Houston, Texas, a tremendous amount of low-wage jobs. And the differentiator have been a smaller subset have generated good jobs. But the troubling fact is that the low-wage jobs are the biggest part of our recovery. And it's only in more modest places, so to speak, relatively few places that have generated more high-wage jobs.
So that is buried in so much that's going on these days, and we do not by any means ignore it here at the show. I want to look at the map and kind of listen to the map for a second here of what is coming back. We'll look at how it's coming back, but there are real differences in you know, who's resurgent and who's not. Here's just a few glimpses of that, Richard, and you'll know the sound of this, but here's a little bit out of New York. Gilt Group founder Kevin Ryan sold advertising site DoubleClick to Google for $3.7 billion. Now, New York had the finance industry that had all the problems at the beginning of the recession, but here's this techie guy telling Bloomberg Television in September that New York is now carving out its niche in the technology world.
So New York has produced in the last 8 years, you know, BuzzFeed, Huffington Post, Business Insider, which is mine, and Gawker. And I think all four of those are bigger than any pure content producing company that, you know, writes articles in San Francisco.
Yeah, take that, San Francisco. New York on that bandwagon. Energy, big deal. Means a lot to Houston, Oklahoma City, New Orleans, Sioux Falls, Bismarck, all over Wyoming. Here's Wall Street Journal reporter Russell Gold reporting from Williston, North Dakota, not long ago.
In the summer of 2005, North Dakota was the eighth largest oil producing state. Today it's number two. It's already passed OPEC member Ecuador in terms of production, and it's closing in on another OPEC member, Qatar.
Qatar, North Dakota, North Dakota alone closing in on Qatar. And here's the sound of, yes, all that high-tech stuff out of a San Francisco interview with Bloomberg Television, CEO of the online real estate site Redfin, Glenn Kelman here.
It would be hard to say that it's not as crazy as we thought it would be. We wondered if some of the performance problems that Zynga and Groupon and other stocks had would limit the madness, but it really hasn't. Google is doing so well. LinkedIn is doing well. Facebook is doing well. Places like Noe Valley, homes last only a few hours before they're under contract. So it seems like the madness is not going to stop. We don't know when it will.
Crazy real estate madness back in San Francisco. Take us onto the map, Richard. I don't know, sort of march us across the country, if you would. You want to go east to west, or how do we do this?
Sure, or even jump around.
Okay.
The first thing is that was striking to me is I had predicted that New York would bounce back as a big, diverse, heterogeneous economy with lots more to offer than finance, mm-hmm. media, entertainment. What I could not predict, and what is strikingly shocking to me, which came out of that conversation, was the bounce in technology jobs. You know, New York has attracted on the order of $2 or $2.5 billion a year in venture investment. And that's literally in a part, the lower part of the island of Manhattan. It's become one of the two or three largest recipients of high-tech startups. And that's because some of these techies, you know, there used to be the idea that techies wanted to be in a Nerdistan, a place, you know, with office parks and a suburban off-ramp, and they could drive their mm-hmm. high-performance cars to work.
Yep.
But many of this new generation of techies are urbanites. The same thing has happened in San Francisco. You know, one of the things I've been writing about is Silicon Valley remains strong, but San Francisco is actually now outpacing Silicon Valley as a location for these startups. And of course, the downside of that is these real estate prices, as you mentioned, have gone through the roof. In addition to that, on the bi-coastal tech economy, and that's also happening in parts of L.A. They call it the Silicon Beach out near Venice and Santa Monica,
mm-hmm.
And actually parts of San Diego as well, Boston, Cambridge area around MIT.
Sure.
Now you see the energy boom, you know, going from Houston back to fueling growth around New Orleans and very hard-troubled parts of Louisiana. And North Dakota, you know, who would have thought? Who would have thought that North
Bismarck,
Dakota—
Fargo.
And the growth there in jobs and high-paying jobs. And again, I talk about some of the costs of fracking and that we have to be realistic about. But it is powering a boom. And then what's happened, of course, is the places that have been hard hit are two. One is the old Rust Belt centers that have really, you know, hitched their wagon to old declining industries. Some of those remain hard hit. I talk about St. Louis, where 90% of the new job growth has been low-wage jobs. What a troubling fact. And Buffalo, Milwaukee, which are struggling to come back. But of course, Detroit, it's very interesting. You know, I had written about Detroit and been very worried about their future. And maybe I underestimated. Now, Detroit is a terribly troubled place with a huge amount of poverty and segregation and racial strife. But boy, oh boy, in terms of productivity improvement, the bounce back of manufacturing, and now it's got a little high-tech cluster, and then the sprawling Sunbelt areas, you know, the places that really didn't – and I point this out, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
We have confused in America population growth with economic growth. It's a big part of the essay.
Okay.
We kind of say, is a place growing if it generates population? we found zero correlation between places that grow population and places that improve innovation, build their productivity, generate high-wage jobs. So they were almost building fake – I can't figure a better word. They almost had a false economy where they thought by building more homes and spurring more construction, they would build more jobs and incomes would rise, and it fell apart.
That's a new angle on the Sun Belt.
And some of those places have been really troubled, but you know, fortunately, some of them are beginning to bounce back and beginning to invest in their real economies. And I talk in the piece about Las Vegas, you know, a place that's probably been the hardest hit by the recession, even more than Detroit, and how, you know, with Tony Hsieh and what's going on in downtown, they're building, you know, Zappos is the shoe, online shoe companies coming back downtown. They're building a little tech cluster. So in the even in the gloomiest parts of the nation, I don't want to paint too much of a gloss on this, we see some signs of resurgence. And where it's happening, it's about innovation, it's about productivity, it's about knowledge. And you know, you're going to talk to the mayor of Nashville, who's a fabulous guy, but how Nashville is not only healthcare and education, but music and manufacturing. So bringing knowledge work and high-tech work into all segments of our economy.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about who's hot and who's not among American cities and regions on this side of the Great Recession, looking at the new geography of success and vulnerability, where the comeback is and where it's not. With Richard Florida, joins us from New York. He's written a big piece in the October issue of The Atlantic magazine, The Boomtowns and Ghost Towns of the New Economy. We're going to hear in just a moment from the mayor of Nashville, Nowville, they're calling it these days. Let's get a call right here from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Alexandra's calling. Alexandra, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. What do you see?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to let everyone know that I'm a recent graduate here who basically planned my entire young adult life to move as far away from Oklahoma as I possibly can. But now after graduating and pondering my graduate level education, I think that I'm actually going to stick around. The infrastructure here is booming. It's oil and gas is trickling down into all these other industries, public works projects that are improving the infrastructure. And we're finally getting some kind of cool places that are neat to hang out at. We're not just cowboys and backwater hicks anymore.
So it's keeping you home. Are you going to work in the energy field, Alexander, or something else just benefiting from its rub off?
Well, because of the energy field, there are so many people that are moving in, and this is really improving our economy. I want to work in the nonprofit sector, which is getting a lot of run because lots of people here want to improve the community and the lives of people who are moving here from these other places.
But Alexandra, going to stick right there. Appreciate your call. Richard Florida will go to the mayor of Nashville in just a second, but your quick thought on Oklahoma City.
Well, Oklahoma City is a remarkable story. What a great mayor there who's focused on making Oklahoma City not only a booming economy but a better place for all sorts of people like Alexandra to live. But one of the things I point out in the piece, and Alexandra made this point, she nailed it. It's not a country that's an energy versus a knowledge economy. And some people, even Tom Friedman, sort of said, these natural resource places all around the world don't invest in education. The U.S. is different. Houston has generated not only an Oklahoma City, an energy economy, but a knowledge technology energy economy. Same thing's true in Calgary up in Canada, where I spend part of my time. And I talk about in the piece that we should no longer think of our country as energy versus knowledge. But I actually say, Tom and listeners, I say we have a new growth model, which is energy and knowledge. And even in our most energy-intensive places, you know, Houston and Oklahoma City have incredible concentrations of software engineers and techies working in the energy sector. Mm-hmm. So I think we've made a false division, and the rebound in Oklahoma City is not just about extraction. It's about generating knowledge, generating value, and making the whole city a better place under the leadership of their great mayor.
Richard Florida, please stand by in New York. Let's talk to another mayor in a hot city. Mayor Carl Dean joins us right now from Nashville, Tennessee. Been mayor since 2007 there. Forbes magazine has ranked Nashville number 2 in the country for the best big cities for jobs in 2013, right behind San Francisco. It was not always so. I mean, just glowing stuff out there. Gallup ranks it in the top 5 regions for top growth. Big Entrepreneurs Group calls it one of the best places to start a new technology startup. Critics talk about, and I have tasted it recently, the big food scene there. GQ magazine calls it simply Nowville. Mayor Carl Dean in Nashville, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
What's going on in your town? We always knew you make great music, but this is more than music.
Well, I think we've had a great year, and there's been sort of national recognition of what's going on in Nashville. But we've been working on this building a city for, you know, long before I became mayor, and I think the city really benefits from having a diverse economy. We were the healthcare management capital, really, of the United States. We're obviously a big place for universities, which are a huge part of our economy. Hospitality is important. State government's important. And, of course, the music industry, which is enormous here, is also important. So the city has been, I think, increasingly attractive to young people as a place to move to have a great place to work in terms of the amenities the city has to offer, but also a really good chance to establish and have a great career.
You know, New York Times writing about you guys in Nashville, talking about America's it city, and different places have it. Dallas had it, Vegas had it, Austin had it. Now it's you. What do you think has sort of brought you up into this national attention in this chapter, Mayor?
Well, I think some of it is that we've been very conscious about talking about the diversity of the music scene in Nashville and about the great appeal of country music, but also what's going on here with rock music. The television show Nashville has certainly helped. I think there's a recognition that our universities are incredibly strong and people want to be here. People ask me all the time, what do we make of this It City thing? And I say, you know, it's great. It's an honor. Enjoy it while it lasts. But the thing that really has made a difference in Nashville is that we have tried to stay focused on three things, which are public education, public safety, and economic development. You know, when I go to bed at night, those are the things I worry about, not whether we're the It City or where we rank on a magazine ranking. What I care about is the city being a great place to live and having a strong economy.
Richard, Florida, look across the whole country and then zero in on Nashville. What do you see going on in this city that's brought so much attention to it lately?
Well, I'm very lucky. I just spent a good part of last week, my first visit to Nashville, and spent time with the mayor. And I think one of the things folks have to realize is that when people talk about servant leadership or leading by empowering others, Mayor Dean represents that as much as any other figure I've seen. I watched him interact and empower Chamber of Commerce people and healthcare leaders and rock musicians. And in a way that I think what his leadership did there is all of these things were bubbling up independently. Nashville was becoming a center for healthcare and healthcare management. The other thing that came, because I studied manufacturing in a previous life, Nashville's had 15% growth in manufacturing. It is a center for foreign direct investment, Japanese and American and European auto production, a kind of Detroit of the South in a way with a new angle on that. But the music thing, you know, I was talking to the music people, and I got to sing Happy Birthday to the mayor with a fellow named Jack White, kind of a high point of my life,
yeah,
believe it
okay.
or not.
Yeah.
You know, I think we should change the name of our band, Mr. Mayor, from the Detroit Moves to the mayor's office.
Oh, come on.
But anyway, one of the things I saw there was the musicians talk about how the mayor empowered them and how forming what they call the music council made them feel part – you know, they felt like they were, in the words of one of them, a second-class citizen in the past. But under the mayor's leadership, they became part of something bigger than their own industry, something bigger than their own studio. And I think what Nashville represents is different than Austin or Silicon Valley. It is much more of, in my verbiage, an integrated knowledge economy or an integrative creative economy where you don't need a college degree. You can be a factory worker, a service worker, a healthcare worker, a music person, and you're all part of this the foodie scene.
But
everyone is on the same page and feels empowered. And I think the mayor has played a huge role in that.
Mayor Dean, what about the low wage, low pay issue? It's afflicting a lot of the country. I mean, even in places that have plenty of growth going on. What about Nashville?
Well, I think, you know, we've seen our salaries go up, and one of the things that's most attractive about Nashville is that the cost of living is cheaper here. So when you look at the spread between what people are earning here and what the cost of living is, it makes it even more attractive because people then have more disposable income. And I think that's helped with, say, the restaurant scene, the sports, and the music. You know, Tennessee has a lot of attractions, and one of the big attractions in Tennessee is that it is a business-friendly state, as Nashville's a business-friendly city. It's a low-tax state, and we're a low-tax city, and that has been part of our appeal. And certainly we have benefited in the last few years from folks who've decided that this is the sort of the environment that they want to do business in.
And you're talking that up as a Democratic mayor. I've got a caller from Nashville for you, Mr. Mayor. Han is calling from Nashville. Han, you're on the air with Mayor Carl Dean. Thanks for calling.
Yes, sir. I wanted to see what Mayor Dean had to say about our governor's refusal to accept the Affordable Health Care Act's Medicare enhancements and the fact that some of our major corporations and universities are actually losing jobs in the medical field because of that refusal to join in. And I'll hand it off to you.
Han, I appreciate your call. Mayor Dean, states where governors have refused to get in that have got a lot of attention. You're a big medical center. Is that hurting your medical industry?
Well, I think we've seen this in the last couple of months. Hospitals in particular have had pressure on them to make cuts because they're not earning the income they were earning before.
Is it because of Governor Bill Haslam's decision to opt out of the path of...
Well, from what I understand from, you know, I've talked obviously to the head of Vanderbilt's medical group about this, and you know, I think that's a portion of it. It's certainly not all of it. Part of it is the population is aging into government-supported insurance versus private insurance, and then there are other sort of financial issues related to it. It's not the entire issue, but it's certainly part of it. And what the governor has tried to do is to find sort of a third way, a Tennessee way of dealing with this, and we'll see how that goes. I mean, I'm obviously, you know, right now in Nashville, you know, we're anxious to see our medical sector of our economy continue to flourish, and we'll see how it plays out. But this is something that the governor has had discussions with the White House and others in D.C. trying to find a different solution, and I wish him the best of luck.
Yeah, your fellow citizen Han as well, he sees jobs being lost on that beam. But overall, Nashville doing very well these days. Mayor Carl Dean there, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Great to have you with us. Richard Florida, lots of comments from around the country here. Jeffrey says, in Dubuque, Iowa, technology and advanced manufacturing are the booming industries. Salome says, Seattle has 4.7% unemployment. That's low. And the real estate market booming. Biggest factor, diversified economy, companies that perform well. Oh, and she says, a Democratic-controlled state government. Okay. Ed says, shale gas been a boom for Western PA. Fracking issues aplenty, but Ed's applauding the shale gas there. Mike says, Waterbury, Connecticut does not seem to have recovered from the 80s recession. Still kind of a little wallowing going on there, Richard.
Yeah, I want to go back to the question you asked the mayor about low-wage jobs, mm-hmm. because I spoke with the mayor and the chamber, and I really challenged them. You know, this is a city that Nashville that's had tremendous, a great ride, right? As you said, it's high income, productivity's up, one of the fastest levels of job growth and wage growth. And what I noted, they did a remarkable report under the mayor's leadership of their music industry. One job in the music industry stimulates 10 jobs in restaurants, service work, personal services. We know from other research, one job in technology or healthcare stimulates an additional 5 jobs in low-wage support. And what I challenge them with is the fact that we've got to extend this model and upgrade the low-wage jobs. You know, in America, we've had nearly 1.7 million new low-wage jobs formed, nearly 2-to-1 against high-wage jobs. It's 1.7 low-wage jobs to 1 high-wage job.
And is it different in the booming cities or not? Is it there or wherever?
Well, the mayor said something very profound. What I found in my own research is even though the wages are higher for a low-wage job, a personal service worker, a food prep worker, a McDonald's worker, a Walmart worker, even though they're higher in San Francisco and New York than they might be in Nashville, those workers can't catch up given the housing cost. So the advantage of a smaller region is what the mayor said, more affordability. But I do think in America, I think we need a new commitment. And I do believe we're doing this conference in New York called City Lab, bringing mayors, including Mayor Dean, from around the world together. I think mayors are going to have to lead on this idea of upgrading the low-wage jobs. And the example I would use here is there was a time where manufacturing jobs in America before the Great Depression were horrible low-pay jobs. Mm-hmm. And in the Depression, under the leadership of FDR and others, we said if we're going to grow our country and build a middle class, we've got to make factory workers' jobs better, and we did it. And I think we've got to focus on, as you said, we've got to make these – you know, these low-wage jobs are paying minimum wage or less to about $12 an hour. Mm-hmm. You can't live on that. And that's the big growth jobs. You know, 15% of our job growth in – after the crisis in the recovery have been temp jobs.
Yeah.
We've got to make those better jobs, and I think mayors have a lot to offer there.
We will look more at that. Eric is calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Eric, you're on the air with Richard Florida. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in asking Richard about St. Louis in particular. I have a soft spot in my heart for the city. I grew up there.
Yeah.
Spent my first 15 years there before going off to college. And I'm curious, he mentioned that 90% of the jobs there are low-wage jobs. Why does Richard feel that St. Louis is not able to capitalize on the 21st century economy to be a player more along the lines of a Nashville or an Austin or elsewhere?
It's a great question. And Richard, thank you, Eric. I hope you'll look at St. Louis, Richard, and maybe throw in a little bit of Buffalo and Milwaukee, too, which you mentioned earlier. Why not for these? St. Louis first.
Yeah, it was 90% of their job growth were low wage. Not that 90% of their jobs are low wage. That would be truly horrendous. And other places that had this, Riverside, California, Tampa, Orlando, Rochester, New York. I mentioned Memphis, Birmingham, Alabama, Milwaukee, Cleveland. I think St. Louis has tremendous assets. You know, obviously it has spectacular universities, just first-class universities and a good location. I think probably, and I've not been to St. Louis in a while, probably there's not been the focus on growing those industries and growing those capabilities. And the positive side of this is what I see happening in a place like Detroit, that if it's anything in much worse shape overall than St. Louis, but has begun even in horrific bankruptcy, you know, and a city down on its knees, to begin to focus on real assets. So I think Mayor Dean laid it out. You know, focus on the basics, make sure you're safe, make sure you've got good schools, and then focus on his third priority, economic development. And I think in the places that what I think Mayor Dean represents is a place that sees everything as an asset. A healthcare sector is an asset. Education sector is an asset. Rock musicians are an asset. Manufacturing is an asset. Put it all together. And in some – I don't want to pick on St. Louis, but in some of the older communities, they've tended to say, well, techies are an asset. Healthcare is an asset. But the rest of it, it's an afterthought.
Putting you mean all the cultural together. Part that you've famously written about?
Yeah, all of it. You know, and manufacturing and empowering. You know, when I was in Nashville, one of the most impressive places I went to was this old warehouse that a bunch of youngsters had taken over. But they weren't tech. Oh, I guess they were techies. They were assembling motorcycles, custom motorcycles. They were assembling these really interesting signs, lighted signs. They were working in a wood shop, making these really interesting, or kind of makers, so to speak, to use the current parlance. But everyone was part of this transformation, and that's where I think all of our communities have to go. And when that happens, you begin to see remarkable turnarounds, and you see them all across the country.
We've got a lot more to look at. I just keep scratching my head, though, on Eric's question. I mean, you know, cities like St. Louis, you know they want it. You know they want the growth. People care about their own cities. They want it to be there, and yet it's just harder sometimes.
And I think I think one of the things I've learned from living in Canada, where it's much more of a government-driven economy, what really seems to work in some of these cities is what I'd call the new kind of private-public partnership. This is what I saw in Detroit, where it was a group of private sector leaders coming together and funding renewal and not waiting for government to lead. So I think that is something a community like St. Louis could seize upon, and as business leadership get more focused on rebuilding the economy.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at the post-recession map of the American economy with Richard Florida. His big piece in the October issue of The Atlantic is the boom towns and ghost towns of the new economy. You can link to that piece at our website, onpointradio.org. We're going to look in a few minutes at the real estate markets around the country and how they're maybe in reaction to this map of the new post-recession economy, how they're responding. And you can join us as well. Lots of response. It's interesting online, Richard, from around the country. Paulie says, Texas is a state with very high numbers of low-wage workers, uninsured people, underfunded public schools, a conservative dream of inequality, Paulie writes. It seems as if this has become a model for success. But then here's another listener, a 29er, who's not so crazy about the stuff that may be driving success in Washington and New York either, writes, the Scylla and Charybdis. Washington, D.C. and New York are doing just fine. Both towns are flush with freshly printed Fed bucks, with plenty of jobs spying on Americans and playing craps at the New York Stock Exchange. A little skepticism from a couple of angles there, Richard.
Well, I guess I want to make two points that are really the big points in the article, and they come near the end, you know, after that map that we talked about kind of portraying the change. And the first point I want to make is I think we're on to a growth model that has a lot of potential. A lot of people have been down on America. But when I looked at this – now it's far from complete. We're in the early days. You know, this is like looking at right after the Depression before World War II.
But you say clear away the rubble and you can see the country's formidable strengths.
When you look at this combination of knowledge and energy and the beginning of a rebound in manufacturing, it's something much more powerful than the old, we're going to build houses and stimulate the auto industry and we're going to have Keynesian growth. This thing is, you know, when I talk, what other country has the universities with? What other country has a Silicon Valley, never mind a New York tech scene, never mind an Austin, never mind a Nashville? What other country has such abundant energy resources? It's an incredible model. But what I say is what the callers and responders are saying. Our contradictions are internal. And it's not simply, and I want to make this point, and I think the conversation online and by the callers are getting at this. Mm-hmm. It's not simply that New York and Washington and Houston and San Francisco are doing better. They may be. Every one of these places is facing greater inequality and a greater divide. And it's not any longer the wealthy people in the suburbs and the poor in the city. The words I like to use, drawing from some great sociologists like Rob Sampson at Harvard, Pat Charkey at NYU, we have now concentrated advantage and concentrated disadvantage side by side.
Yeah.
And it's not just inequality. It's embedded in our communities. And what I said is our country has to now make a new social pact, a new social compact that we're going to spread these benefits. And that's really the challenge of our generation. We have a growth model that can work, but it's only working for the 1% or the 33% of knowledge workers. Let's figure out which what percentage you like.
It is so interesting. You write, if I may just quote you.
66% are falling behind.
Yeah, you write, the main threats to America's growth model do not come from other countries but from domestic contradictions, as you say. Talking about talented people, clustering, you say, as these clusters of highly educated people form and grow, they tend to push out the middle class, resulting in a ruthless sorting of people and places. But there's plenty of concern, certainly in conservative quarters, that if you go to a new social compact to spread the wealth, you kill the golden goose. What do you say to that, Richard?
Well, you know, it makes – when you said that, reading those words made me shiver because I was the big advocate of the clustering. You know, I'm the big advocate with others of the concentration. And it's a hard learning when you see something that's so economically powerful as these techies or energy people clustering. Well, that's going to make us grow. But in a sense, that growth is just benefiting – I don't want to call it a narrow group. It's a large group. But it's not everyone.
Not large enough. Not near.
And what's horrifying about it, as we cluster in these neighborhoods, we create localized advantages, better schools, not just arts and culture, better cultural environment, better exposure for our children, more travel, more interesting people. And the gaps, you know, this wonderful research by this graduate student at Harvard, it's not just inequality. It's a sociological inequality. Pat Sharkey talks about this in his work. That's pulling us apart in ways that none of us could have anticipated, or maybe some of us, but I certainly didn't anticipate a decade ago.
So what would the social compact look like?
What the conservatives are saying is bupkis. You know, it's just bupkis. We need to upgrade these service jobs, and that's where we have to, you know, 66 million Americans toil in crappy, low-wage jobs. We just have to make them better jobs, whether that's a minimum wage, but higher minimum wage, whether that minimum wage varies by cost of living. You know, it might be higher in New York than it is in Nashville. But we've got to make those jobs richer jobs. And when I say richer, more fulfilling jobs, higher paying jobs. Just like we empowered the factory worker on the floor to become partly an innovator and help build a stronger factory, only 6% of our workforce works in actual production. Almost 50% of us works in services. We've got to make those jobs better jobs.
If you do that, are you going to drag down the booming part or not?
I think what we really – that's the best question of all. We have to figure out a model which rewards the peaks, which doesn't cut down our entrepreneurial zeal. Mm. But that doesn't – you know, our most entrepreneurial places are the highest tax places. They're New York and Massachusetts and San Francisco. So it's not that taxes are killing us the way the conservatives say. People can still be productive if the taxes are providing a good environment, good schools, good education, good universities. But we have to pull up the bottom. If not, if we don't pull up the bottom – then we're not going to have everything because our society is going to fray at the margins and fall apart. I'm not pessimistic. Look, we've done this two or three times in the past. We've built new social models as well as economic models. There is a big lag. You know, in the past, it's been a 50 to 100-year lag. Mm-hmm. I think we're smart enough. And I really believe, you know, it's Washington gridlock, but the mayors. You know, you look at a mayor like Carl Dean, who I just had the great fortune to meet last week.
Yeah.
But you look at, you know, a Bill de Blasio, even a Mike Bloomberg, you could, Republican, Democrat, they're all sort of angling towards the same thing, and they're not caught in this ridiculous partisan gridlock. So I do think it's going to come from local model. You know, these models will be built locally, and sooner or later we'll get there. If I can't even imagine what would happen to our country if we fail to do this.
I mean, in the meantime, it does matter where you are on that map as we I hope, try to work all this out. But you're right, a poor person from a knowledge center like San Jose or San Francisco has twice the chance of becoming wealthy as a poor person from some Rust Belt or Sun Belt centers like Cleveland or Atlanta. It matters.
Yeah, and what's terrifying about that is the least advantaged people have the hardest time moving.
Yeah.
So if you're fortunate enough to be born in a place that has a booming economy, like I was born to a factory worker. I was born in Newark, New Jersey, grew up in New Jersey, could go to Rutgers University and get a path to upward mobility.
Yeah.
But if you're born in a place that doesn't have those advantages, doesn't have close by good universities or the ability – and you know what? I probably couldn't have that advantage today. A working class kid – from Newark, New Jersey, or North Arlington, where I grew up, probably is going to have a lot harder time getting into Rutgers University than I did. I doubt my grades would have gotten me in because these state universities are attracting young people from all over the world now, the best and the brightest. So I think it's where you're born. And one of the big problems we have is, as many have discussed, not just me, if you're a low-income person, if you're born in a neighborhood that's disadvantaged, not only do you feel local problems and it's harder to get out, it's a harder time getting to move. So we've got to address this now in America. And I think, it's, you know, the New York election, to me, you know, being in New York today, really made this clear.
Tale of two
that
cities,
it's not enough for New York's
message.
Economy to boom. The economy has to start to benefit more people. Yes, the boom is great. And we're happier that there's a boom. But that boom is creating a lot of inequality. And now's the time to address it. And I hope that signals a change in our outlook in America.
Well, it seems to be dawning. We'll see. You kind of need a decent floor and a very good way up.
Nicely
said. For the whole country.
Nicely said.
To thrive. Richard Florida writes about all this, lays out the new map of the American economy in the Atlantic October issue, The Boomtowns and Ghost Towns of the New Economy. Link to it at our website. Richard Florida, always great to have you. Thank you very much for being with us today.
And thank you for making this part of our national conversation. We all really appreciate it, Tom.
You are so welcome for that. Richard Florida, thanks for being here. In a moment, we'll look at what's happening in the real estate market. This is On Point. Home prices have climbed, but their upward momentum may be slowing. We'll look at where home prices are strong and what regions are still feeling the brunt of the downturn. Joining me now from Washington is Diana Olick, CNBC real estate correspondent and author of the Realty Check blog on CNBC.com. Diana Olick, welcome. It's great to have you, as always, On Point.
Well, Tom, thanks for having me.
So draw the map for us. What's hot and what's not in real estate?
Well, you have to look at what was the worst, and that's what's now rising the most. So you look at the really hard-hit spots like Phoenix, Las Vegas, a lot of California. Those are markets where investors really swooped in. They took out a lot of the distress from the housing market, and now home prices are jumping in the double digits, up over 20% in those areas. Again, they're still off their peaks of 2006, but they are strong markets, and actually some of the investors are now moving out because the competition is just too hot there.
I mean, is it double digit because, you know, down so low it looks like up to me? Are they just having these big jumps because they were really on the floor in the cellar?
Yeah, you're looking at price drops of, you know, 45% to 50% from the peak of the housing boom in 2006. So that's why you see such big jumps up. But they're also approaching, you know, some really competitive ranges, and that's why the investors are moving out, and they're moving into other spots like, say, Atlanta and parts of the Carolinas where they're seeing better deals, and they're still seeing a lot of distress in the market. We have a report that shows that delinquencies are way down, the foreclosure inventories are way down, off, you know, 34% from just a year ago. So that distress is moving out, and that's why you're seeing home prices gain, not just in some of these formerly hard-hit markets, but really across the country. Of course, you have to add to that that there's really nothing for sale right now. Inventories are so low that even though you don't have really strong sales demand, prices are still going up because what is there to buy is getting a lot of competition.
Why such low inventory? You would think that there would always be mobility, people moving around or retiring, moving south. I don't know. Why such low inventory?
Two words, negative equity. You know, we talk about home prices rising, but they're still nowhere near where they were during the peak when a lot of people bought their houses. So the trouble is you have people who bought with zero down, their home prices are still down, they're still underwater on their mortgages, and if they're not underwater, they may not be above water enough to afford that move up. That is, they don't have the 20% down for the next house and the real estate agent's commission, so they are essentially stuck in place. You have really millions of homeowners who can't move because of negative or near negative equity. And then you also have a lot of folks who are saying, okay, we're seeing prices rise, we're at the bottom, but I'm going to wait a little bit longer to see if I can get something better in the spring.
You talked about Phoenix and Las Vegas as places that had been very hard hit, bouncing back with big double-digit numbers. Are there hard hit places from the recession that have not come back, Diana?
Well, Detroit is still not looking very well. There are parts of the Midwest that are not rebounding as fast as we might like to see them in Ohio. You know, the numbers are coming up, definitely, but again, you still have low inventory there and you don't have as much investor demand. Florida is still in a troubled spot. Parts of it are doing well. Miami has a lot of foreign investor demand, so you're seeing, you know, big jumps in sales and prices there. But the rest of Florida is still very slow in the foreclosure process. It has to do with, you know, states that use a judge or don't use a judge in the foreclosure process. In the Northeast, places like New Jersey and New York still have huge foreclosure inventory just because it's so slow to get those homes through the pipeline, through the courts, and finally back out onto the market again. So in spots like that, you're not seeing the price appreciation that you would see in other hard-hit markets where the foreclosures came through really fast, the investors came in, swooped them up, and prices recovered.
So what about those stronger home real estate markets that didn't take quite as big a hit? What's happening with them now?
Well, you probably talk about Texas. That is a great market right now, both Houston and Dallas. They did not take a huge hit during the recession, and now they're coming back very strong. And that's just due to jobs. I mean, we can talk a lot about the crash and what caused the housing crash, et cetera, but really housing is all about jobs, strong employment. And Texas is really seeing an influx of jobs. They're seeing a lot of buyer demand. They did not see a huge overbuilding during the housing boom, so supplies there are still very low, and that's creating big price increases and just a very strong market in both Houston and Dallas.
So how do you describe overall the health of the housing market? Is it possible now to call it healthy, or is it weird? It's riven with all these different sort of ahistorical elements.
To call it healthy, I don't think we're there yet to say healthy. Now, of course, all real estate is local, and this recovery is going to be particularly local. As I always say, you know, the crash was national, and that was very rare to see a national housing crash. We hadn't seen that since the Depression. So the recovery is going on more local-to-local basis. We did get new numbers on pending home sales, which showed that they're weakening into the fall. That's because of higher mortgage rates and also because home prices are just rising so fast that it's pricing a lot of people out of the market. It's a tough recovery. It's unlike any other because you are seeing this strange lack of inventory, and you still have a lot of people stuck in place, as I said, due to negative equity.
Yeah.
You have rising mortgage rates, although they are still historically low by any standard. But you have first-time home buyers dropped out of the market entirely because it's not just the credit, the interest rate, it's the credit availability.
Sure.
It's still very tight.
You know, it was such a big driver before the bust. I mean, do you think housing will become a big economic driver in this country again? And should we want it to be, given what we saw there?
Well, not in the near term. I mean, when you look at the forecasts from all the analysts out there, even the realtors are saying that they don't expect a lot of home sales growth in 2014. We're looking at 2016, 2017 until prices really start taking off again. We think they're going to moderate over the next couple of years. So, you know, will we see gains in the economy from housing? We see it in renovations. We see it in other areas, but nothing like we did back in 2005, 2006, and 2007. Should it drive the economy? I think in part it should, but I don't think, you know, there was this big home ownership society that pushed a lot of folks into home ownership who perhaps could not afford it. Mm-hmm. And we have to rethink that right now. There's a huge rental demand. There is a big new market of single-family rentals owned by investors, and they're getting a lot of demand. And there's really nothing wrong with renting if that works for you financially.
You mentioned investor buying, and we had very, very big investment companies buying lots and lots of houses off the bottom of the market, massive investor buying. How do you see that playing out? What effect is that going to have on prices, on housing availability in the years to come?
Well, we talked a lot about it, and there was a lot of investor action in some of those hardest-hit markets, especially, as I said, Phoenix, Las Vegas. But it's still a relatively small percentage of the home buying market, really around 10%. So, yes, they did come in and take up a lot of the distressed homes. So a lot of these investors are playing to hold, and that is they're not looking to flip these homes. They're not looking to sell them. They are seeing good rental income. They're getting good, solid returns, and they expect to hold these homes for 5 to 10 years. So it's not like we're suddenly going to see them exit the market. We have seen some investors sell some houses, and that has sent up a red flag saying, is this the end of the trade? Is it no good, et cetera? But really, it's just a pause right now because we've hit this kind of top in home prices for now. So they are selling some, but I just spoke to a large investor yesterday who said no way is he getting out of the market. He is still buying 1,000 properties a month.
Wow.
And expects to hold these and rent them and see good returns.
Diana Olick with CNBC. Thank you so much, Diana. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.